Robin Hood Radio and the Robin Hood Radio Network is proud to present Leonard Lopate at Large, lively hour-long in-depth discussions providing overviews and context to topics usually covered in partial measures. His guests include leading thinkers, scientists, artists, economists, farmers, historians, authors, and politicians. Mr. Lopate is a Peabody Award winner whose numerous honors include 3 Associated Press Awards and 3 James Beard Awards.
Welcome to Leonard Lopate at Large. I'm Leonard Lopate. The New York Post reported last September that New York City has paid hundreds of millions of dollars over the past 5 years to settle cases of police misconduct. $384 million, in fact. However, stunning that amount is, since New York's annual budget nears $90 billion, it can probably manage it. But what about small towns where a single case of compensating victims of police wrongdoing presents a far greater burden? Regardless of a city's size, however, money spent to pay for police misconduct have to come from somewhere. In an article titled Blood Money, Taxpayers Pick Up the Tab for Police Brutality, Andrew Coburn details the real costs of indemnifying police malfeasance. It's in the November issue of Harper's Magazine and brings Andrew Coburn to our show now. Welcome.
Hey, good to be with you.
You discuss what happened in South Tucson, Arizona, a tiny city surrounded by the city, the large city of Tucson, where in this small town, police officers killed Jose Sinofui and wounded Roy Garcia. But why start with that? Wasn't that decades ago? Is it relevant today?
Well, it is, because the citizens or taxpayers of South Tucson are still paying for it. I mean, this was the original incident was in 1977 when a policeman shot a civilian, Jose Sinawir, the family sued, then there was a judgment against them, which was paid for by insurance, but the insurance company said after that, they walked away from South Tucson, so South Tucson now had no insurance. So then when there was another police shooting and a judgment, actually this time it was totally accidental. It was another policeman who sued. The city couldn't pay. And the city was sliding into bankruptcy. In fact, did go into bankruptcy to meet the because it couldn't afford the $3.5 million suit. But instead, they floated a bond. Put it on the credit card, in other words. So then as years went by, they had to pay the interest. But then when the bond was coming due, they didn't pay it off. They refinanced it. It's like someone continually refinancing a mortgage. But it's exactly like that. So, many, many refinancings, I think it's 6 refinancings later, the citizens South Tucson are still paying for it. And by the time the original bond was just under $2 million, by the time they will, if they ever finally pay it off with the interest, they will have paid $13 million. So that's what you get into. That's what paying for police malfeasance gets you into.
And the officer who killed Jose was ordered to pay $50,000. That's kind of unusual, isn't it?
That's very rare. I mean, that really doesn't happen much these days. Almost never do police, does the individual police officer have to pay? They're usually indemnified by, union contracts. And the police department doesn't have to pay because they usually, by political agreement, they're not liable. I mean, there might be a certain amount set aside in their budgets for meeting these kind of obligations, but that's a set amount. So, whether they have to, if they pay, if the judgment is more, then it's not like more comes out of the budget and they have to cut back on something else like overtime or whatever. It goes on the city's tab. And as often as not, or in many cases, the city will float a bond. In other words, shift the burden onto future future taxpayers or taxpayers in their old age.
South Tucson is tiny, and surrounded by Tucson, it's as if Central Park were a city nestled in the middle of New York. How can a city that size afford to provide public services even under the best of circumstances, especially when, as I understand it, the population of South Tucson is comparatively poor?
It's a poor, it's a poor, largely Hispanic little entity. It, you know, became a city for reasons I don't quite understand, but back quite a, you know, quite a long time ago. But they like their independence, and they like, you know, I was asking when I was researching the story, I said, you know, surely it would make sense just to be folded into Greater Tucson, which is a, you know, comparatively prosperous metropolis. And they said, well, they like having their own police department, which is now just thanks to all the cutbacks, which are caused by having to pay this, pay the interest on the bond, down to 16 people. And they like having their own little fire department, which now is down to 3 people per fire truck. So they, you know, they almost, they've teetered on the edge of bankruptcy and going under several times, but they managed to hang on. And if it wasn't for this onerous debt caused by that long ago shooting, where I think pretty much everyone involved is now dead or certainly retired, you know, they'd be okay. They could struggle on. But it's, as in so many other cases, it's this legacy of a of an event that you know, that cripples little towns and sometimes big towns like South Tucson.
51 years after the fact. Would you say that your article is more about who bears responsibility for police misconduct rather than the misconduct itself?
Yes. I mean, I think it's it means that really no one who's directly involved has to pay, you know, has to take responsibility. You know, if it, you know, if it came out of, if it was the individual policeman or if it was the police department, or if it, even if the city had to pay out of its current, you know, current budget, then, you know, there'd be, people would be hard, some hard thinking, you know, maybe things they would have to change their ways. There'd be accountability. But this way, there is no accountability. I mean, it's, you know, if you just float a bond and, you know, shove it off into the future, it means no one pays. You know, I'm not saying that policemen should be bankrupted or, you know, anything like that. But it feel, you know, this, it means that there's no, whatever might have caused the problem in the first place, doesn't get dealt with. And that, to me, is the main problem.
Don't courts, including the Supreme Court, rely on the notion of qualified immunity for public officials? What is that
they
all about?
They do. Well, that's, you know, that sort of crept in, has been growing in force really since the, starting with the Rehnquist Court. I mean, it's basically, it's a way of letting public officials off the hook. It doesn't deal with the problem we're discussing of, you know, having to, people having to pay out the money, but it means that individual officers or, you know, public officials, this is not just about police, aren't held accountable. It's a fairly pernicious doctrine, I think. I mean, why should they? as long as, you know, it basically says they get a pass as long as they can be argued that they were behaving reasonably.
So how can they be deterred from acting badly when they're protected from the costs of their misconduct?
Well, that's right. You know, I mean, it doesn't always happen. I mean, we just had a judgment a few weeks ago in Chicago where the officer who killed Laquan McDonald was found guilty basically of second-degree murder. This was a, you know, notorious case in Chicago where basically, an officer shot a black youth, I think 19, from memory, 19 times, largely in the back. I may have that number wrong, but it was an excessive number of, and even, you know, and the jury found him guilty, which was the first time, I think, in over 50 years that an officer in Chicago has been found guilty of homicide. So, you know, it does happen. That was obviously, you know, no one, well, people did try and argue he was acting reasonably, but that defense didn't wash. Now they're, I think it's still going on, kind of the trial of officers who were at the scene who participated in a cover-up, and they're being, you know, tried for conspiracy. Which is very hard to prove. So I doubt, well, I can't say, and if there has been a verdict, forgive me, I've been distracted by other events, but, you know, basically people aren't held accountable. And it's, the thing is, you know that when police departments do change their ways, you know, change the method of training, change the rules so that resorting to force, resorting to deadly force is not a first resort. Things, you know, you get different results. I mean, cities where resort to deadly force is not the first option. I mean, you're meant to explore all other options before you shoot someone. Homicide police, law enforcement homicides have declined by 25%. Cities where chokeholds are banned, I think deaths at the hands of police declined by, I think it's a figure around 20%. I mean, so there are reforms that can be put in place that make a big difference. And yet, because, as I've been saying, there's no accountability, there's no big incentive necessarily to institute those reforms.
There is a thing called the Action Center on Race and the Economy, ACRE. They found, looked at 12 cities and counties, including Chicago, Los Angeles, Nassau County, New York City's neighbor on Long Island, and from 2008 to 2017, bond borrowing totaled $878 million to cover police-related settlements and judgments. But real costs were over $1 billion more than that. Why is that? And in the case of, why is Chicago the one that has borrowed over $700 million? It's if you subtract Chicago, the remaining 11 cases total less than $170 million. So is Chicago just a really bad situation?
Well, it is, yes. Although I want to say that, you know, it's not like all police shootings are totally unjustified. I mean, we just had a tragic case this week in Chicago, where a young officer was killed stopping a crazed gunman who was killing people in a hospital. So I don't want to sound like I, make sound too negative about the police. But to answer that point, yes, I mean, there's a history of police misconduct in Chicago, which never seems to have been adequately dealt with, going back for years and years. And I mean, they talk about the blue line. I mean, when that notorious case I mentioned earlier happened, basically, the police department closed ranks to defend and cover up for this particular officer who'd shot a perfectly innocent fellow in the back. But the other thing to bear in mind is that one of the reasons that ACRE, who did this excellent report, Action on Race and the Economy, Action Center on Race and the Economy, on which I based this article, they make the point that, you know, it's not always easy to trace these bonds. In some places it is. In California, let me back up. When you have a $3 million judgment against a city for police misconduct, and the city wants to issue a bond, it can issue, and this happens tends to happen in California, can issue what's called a judicial obligation bond, where they say this bond is to pay for the judgment, you know, where Mr. So-and-so was awarded $3 million or whatever. Or it can be just a general obligation bond where the city says, you know, and its prospectus for issuing the bond says, well, we need $3 million and, you know, $10 million or whatever, and doesn't say what it's for. ACRE did an excellent job of tracing, and and it took them a lot of time, I think I spent over 2 years on it, tracing which bonds were actually for this purpose. And it very much depends on the way various cities keep records. So Chicago, as it so happens, it was not too difficult to track, how much money they'd raised, or how much the worth of the bonds they'd issued for, this particular purpose.
They call them police brutality bonds.
Police brutality bonds, exactly. But other cities, we just don't know. I mean, it seems like New York doesn't do it that much, but other big cities, Aker said to me, L.A. could be as big as Chicago, but we just don't know because it's all buried in the accounting. So, as I say, Chicago accounts for a disproportionate amount of the 800 million or so, but it could be a lot more. Could be a lot hidden in other cities. Deep in the books.
I'm speaking with Andrew Coburn, whose article "Blood Money: Taxpayers Pick Up the Tab for Police Brutality" is in the November issue of Harper's Magazine. You're listening to Leonard Lopate at Large on WBAI New York 99.5 FM. New York City has had a civilian complaint review board since 1953. Do any other cities have something similar? Does that help?
And yeah,
I was
do.
Wondering whether a small city like South Tucson could even maintain something like that.
No, they couldn't. I mean, no, certainly not South Tucson with it. They're really scraping the barrel, poor things, to try and keep the show on the road.
I mean, how did you discover them? They're such a small community.
I just came across it in the rummaging through. The internet is a wonderful thing, and I felt very sorry for them. I mean, it was very interesting, sort of probing, really researching the finances of a tiny city. For example, one of the costs that they find really hard to bear is animal control, because they have stray dogs coming over the line from Tucson that have to be taken care of, have to be taken to the, they have an animal pound, and it's an appreciable expense. It's like little things like that. A little town, I mean, one of the things that threw their budget out of whack was when a particular Chinese restaurant closed, hitting their sales tax revenues. So it was fascinating to go back, and they, the people, I was able to tell them some of the things, the details of that long ago shooting in 1977. All the people now in the sort of city administration, such as it is, had come in since then, so they had no idea quite on the origins of this crippling debt that they have to, they're faced with all the time.
Over $3.6 million for a city with fewer than 6,000 people. That comes to about $500 per person.
Right. It's it's an incredible burden. I mean, it really, you can get into a wider argument as whether municipal bonds are the best way to finance cities. The alternatives aren't so great either when they put on a sales tax. I mean, and there was another town I talk about in the article where they, the police, one of these sort of out of control SWAT teams came in and basically gunned down a young man who was accused of being a drug dealer, and his family sued, got money, and the city issued a bond, but then to pay off the bond, they issued a tax. They imposed a property tax. And this tax, even the dead man was called John Herco. So the tax was known for years as the John Herco tax. I mean, every time someone, wrote out their check for their property taxes, part of it was for the John Herco tax. But the other thing, element of it is that, in a way, I've been saying that this, no one immediately responsible pays, but the taxpayers pay. But to, you know, the thing about paying the interest on a bond is you have to pay it. It has to be the number one priority. You can't say, well, we'd rather put the money into, you know, schools or, you know, mental health or something. We can't really afford to pay the interest this year. No, you have to. Or else the bondholders, you know, pretty soon you'll find yourself in very deep trouble and, you know, probably into forced bankruptcy. So what happens is that you know, to pay the interest year after year, you have to cut back, you have to make economies elsewhere. And what particularly struck me, and again, looking at Chicago, but also places like Milwaukee, another outstanding case, Cleveland, and, you know, several smaller cities, you can see the effects of the cutbacks, which, you know, will often be on services in poorer that directly affect poor people, like, you know, mental health counseling or, you know, schools, like in the case of Chicago. You know, in other words, services that would, in the long run, would actually help community-police relations. I mean, if, you know, a huge proportion of the law enforcement homicides or deaths in this country involve mentally ill people. You know, someone who's, you know, who's behaving oddly, like the chap in Chicago, McDonald, and the police decide he's a threat, or he or she is a threat, and shoot them. Well, you know, that reflects right back to a lack of mental health services. So if you cut back on mental health services, for example, then you're going to have more confrontations with the police, more police shootings, more judgments against the police, more bonds, more interest on the bonds, more cutbacks and, you know, on mental health services. It's a vicious circle. So I think, you know, it's one of the more pernicious aspects of this whole state of affairs.
I mentioned that the Post has reported that over the past 5 years, New York has paid $384 million to settle cases of this sort. I don't know if that is higher than other cities or if we're doing better, but I could think of other ways that $384 million could have been spent, like improving the subway system.
Or probably mental health counseling. I mean, the thing I was talking about earlier, you know, a whole host of things. If you improve conditions for society generally, you're not going to have these sort of, you know, lethal events that add to the cost and, of course, cause, you know, undue misery and suffering all around.
Acker argues that Wall Street winds up being the biggest beneficiary.
Well, that's right. I mean, they take the view that, you know, these are good investments. I mean, the cities are always going to pay in the end, I mean, unless they go into bankruptcy. But it's one more investment opportunity, and quite often, you know, municipal bonds, not invariably, but they're the great, generally speaking, they're prized as the tax-free investment, you know, interest, not totally, but to a large degree, on municipal bonds is tax-free, and that's the great inducement. That was the solution to financing American cities. And remember that municipal bonds, generally, the basic justification for them is not to just finance current expenditure, like, you know, paying the salaries of cops and teachers or whatever, or city administrators, but for infrastructure, you know, building a bridge, building a road, repairing, you know, building new schools. And that's the sort of general function of municipal bonds. To give them this role of financing, well, police malfeasance is not really in the original charter. It's not really the notion for it. So it's part of the It's a way, in a way in which the system has gotten skewed.
Isn't private equity a growing force in the provision of public services in some areas like firefighting or emergency medical services?
Yeah, it's absolutely atrocious. And prisons. To a horrifying degree, incarceration is now a profitable, is a business, a for-profit business. We spend, what do we spend a year on incarceration? It's like $80 billion a year.
The Obama administration was cutting back on that, but now it's the Trump administration has begun to rely on private incarceration a lot more.
Absolutely. And they'll sign contracts saying you guarantee us, numbers of inmates. In other words, there's an incentive, to lock up more people to keep the profits of the private prison company up. And that's, of course, particularly happening with this whole, the whole outrageous ongoing crime scene of immigration enforcement, where the hundreds of thousands of immigrants are locked up, many in private, in for-profit institutions. So there's a whole incentive to lock up even more people. But private equity, all services, that's privatization of everything is an ongoing horror show, I think. It's disastrous. We've got, it's a larger topic than just police brutality bonds, but we've got a for-profit military now. More and more. So many of the nation's military functions have taken over by private firms, private contractors. Incarceration, a whole lot of other things: fire and garbage collection. You name it. It's all falling into the hands of private business, private. Often private equity firms, which I think is not good.
You mentioned insurance. Have insurance companies exerted any influence on police practices?
Yes, they have. There's a whole bunch of cities. In fact, it could be argued this is quite a good thing because the insurance, if a city is told, or a police department is told, look, by the insurance company, look, we're not going to cover you because unless or until you clean up your act. That's a powerful incentive to do just that.
So there are no pre-existing conditions in this kind of insurance.
Well, I mentioned one earlier, the poor South Tucson, who got into the jam it's in for all these years because of the pre-existing shooting of the condition of the 1977 shooting, which caused them to lose their insurance, which meant that then when they, the next time they had money to shell out, they couldn't afford it. So I guess there is. But if it's that's an interesting, I hadn't thought of it that way, but that's an interesting precedent.
No Obamacare for police brutality cases. Do you know whether there's been any polling or research on public opinion about the costs of police misconduct?
No, because people aren't, generally aren't aware of it. The people of Chicago aren't really aware that they're on the hook as I said, we know more about Chicago than other places, but they're on the hook for 1.7, I think it'll be $1.7 billion by the time, if and when everything's paid off, which of course it won't be, and so it'll be more. People aren't aware of this, what it all costs. If there was an announcement saying, well, because so-and-so, there's been this judgment, and so-and-so got shot, and we had to pay out that, so therefore we're going to have to close this school or that, that municipal service. I think people might sit up and pay more attention. But generally speaking, because it's issued so often, as I write about, buried in a bond, and a bond, which, as I mentioned, often, we don't know the reason why they're suddenly borrowing the city suddenly has to borrow, you know, $10 million. It's not spelled out. You know, a poll wouldn't reveal, you know, a poll would reveal that, you know, people don't care about it because they don't know about it. You know, it's not like this is an insoluble situation. I mean, cities that, you know, there are wide differences in cities depending on the way that, you know, their style of policing, the training. I mean, some cities have a lot, you know, have a high number of police-induced deaths, and some have none. I mean, I quote an example in the piece between 2013 and 2016, the Buffalo police killed zero people, whereas Orlando, Florida, which is about the same size, has the same racial makeup, same crime rate, killed 15 people.
So does Buffalo have better trained police?
Well, it would seem so. There's something different going on. That would be the suggestion. That's what I understood. So it's you know, cities, and as I mentioned earlier, you know, where particularly this whole resort. I mentioned this in the piece in passing, but the idea that the police are constantly under threat, you know, and therefore, you know, they resort to deadly force quicker. Police departments where that is discouraged, you know, have a very different rate of death this way. I mean, there are some absurd cases of this sort of overreaction. And there was a case, I think, in Georgia this last summer where there was an old woman, an 87-year-old woman who was, you know, had dementia, was, you know, no threat to anyone. And she went out to pick dandelions, to cut dandelions, to make dandelion soup. So she was carrying a knife. And she was wandering along, and a neighbor said, oh, there's a woman with a knife. So the police called it in, the police turned up. And they shouted at her to drop the knife, and she paid no attention. And she was walking towards them, an 87-year-old woman. So they didn't kill her, they just tased her. You know, so she's suddenly, this poor old woman with dementia suddenly gets this violent electric shock because they said they were under threat. They felt under threat from the knife. And this, you know, this happens. This is a very constant thing. I think it's, you know, there's been some interesting studies of police training. You know, police training is very much often in the hands of former military people. There's various firms staffed by special forces graduates who really, you know, the whole impetus, like it is in the military, is to go kinetic, you know, to use deadly force to deal with the situation. You have to control the situation, and you control it with, first of all, with threats of deadly force, and if necessary, with use of deadly force. There's a chap who's forgotten his name for a second. He wrote a big bestseller called On Killing. He studies killing, and he's a former military guy, and he's a very popular, has a huge business training police in police academies and going around to police departments. And, you know, and I've seen video of some of his lectures where he actually, you know, he talks about, you know, how it's, you know, you're the only defense against anarchy, you know, that you're facing anarchy all the time. You're facing chaos. So you have to be ready with your gun to, you know, to defend civilization. And this spirit is, doesn't sound to me that healthy. And it might help explain why so often, you know, people, you know, a kid holding a cell phone is suddenly shot. And the officer says, well, I thought it was a gun. Or, you know, I shouted at him to drop the gun and he didn't, and it was a cell phone or nothing at all, and then they shoot him. I mean, there's, you know, we hear the notorious case in Sacramento. I remember there was a notorious case last year. It's, you know, they pop up at regular intervals.
You're listening to Leonard Lopit at Large. Don't police argue that their work is so dangerous that they need a bit more latitude and indemnity to deal with the risks they take? How dangerous is policing compared to other kinds of work? I would think mining would be difficult. There's a whole bunch of businesses I would think that are rather dangerous.
The most dangerous job, it's actually quite far down the list. I'm not saying it's entirely safe, but it's the most dangerous job is logging. Let's see here, logging, deep sea fishing, commercial fishing, roofing, groundskeeping. For some reason, is high on the list. I think even according to one tabulation, I saw that, just going by the statistics, installing air conditioning equipment, which I guess would mean logic sense, you know, working high up on rooftops, that's more dangerous than policing. So it's actually, I wouldn't say it's totally safe, but compared to a lot of other occupations, it is safer. I mean, last year, I believe, 44 policemen were killed in the line of duty, law enforcement people. That was down from the year before when it was in the 60s. I think it was 66 the year before. I'm not sure exactly how many this year. I mean, you can get, obviously, you know, I'm not calling it a safe occupation, as, you know, we saw a couple of days ago in Chicago. But, you know, it's the notion that, you know, they're like, you know, it's like being on the front line in the battle of, you know, in World War One or something is entirely misplaced. And I think, you know, therefore reacting to the way they do, you know, are trained to do in many cases by, you know, shooting first and asking questions later, is obviously misplaced and should be changed.
Joanna Schwartz, a law professor at UCLA, studied thousands of cases in over 80 law enforcement agencies. What did she find?
Well, she found, first of all, that the police, as she put it, never tend to never pay a dime.
You mean if they've done something, they're never punished financially?
Yeah, that's right. And she says that, you know, that they, there's this, that basically they never get paid. Although she says that, she was the one, she pointed out to me the presumption. Presumption is, you know, when the, you know, your brother, son, father, whatever, has been shot by the police, and, you know, so you find a lawyer, you're outraged, rest of the family is distraught, is outraged, is whatever, and wants some kind of, you know, compensation. It goes to a civil trial, the jury, and this tends to happen more because of, you know, videos, body cams and dash cam videos. The jury sort of is outraged as well and awards the family $5 million. They do it, tend to do it in the belief. They say, well, that's not just we got $5 million, but this will make change. This will make, you know, this is punitive. I mean, often there's a certain amount of punitive damages that the policeman is going to pay or the police department is going to suffer for having, you know, gunned down whoever it was. But in fact, that never happens because, as I said earlier, you know, they don't pay. They don't. Neither the individual officer nor the police department actually has to suffer in any particular way because of this event. And that's something that Schwartz really. I mean, she uncovered this. I mean, before it was kind of anecdotal, and she was the one who sort of thing. It's interesting work for a law professor. She went through, as you said, thousands of cases and found this was the case. But it's this misplaced notion that, you know, a big judgment against the police will have an effect, will have a direct effect in making things better. I mean, there is, I should say, of course, particularly notorious cases where the police, obviously, you know, something's badly wrong in the department, then until recently, you've had the Justice Department will step in and, you know, do a huge investigation, and say, you know, well, there's all sorts of reforms the police department needs to adopt, you know, ranging from, you know, changes in training to having, you know, body cams or whatever. And then the city signs a consent decree agreeing to institute these reforms. Now, two things about that. One is the Trump Justice Department and the former of recently departed, unlamented Attorney General, Mr. Sessions, Jeff Sessions, he ended that. In fact, it was his last act as Attorney General, was to say, no more consent decrees. We shouldn't be interfering in law enforcement, in local law enforcement in this way. So that, at least for the moment, is off the books. But even when it has happened, of course, it's a further cost of the original police, you know, malfeasance, police whatever happened, because now not only do they have to pay out, by whatever means, millions of dollars to the bereaved family, but they also have to find the money to institute these reforms, which can be quite expensive. It's another cost.
Well,
police malfeasance.
You mentioned a 2017 Chicago case where a jury awarded $44.7 million to a man who was shot by a drunken officer, a cop that had a record of violent behavior. So are courts and juries doing what mayors or legislators or police departments should be doing?
Well, yes, that's right. I mean, that this officer, who was clearly, you know, should never have been allowed anywhere near law enforcement, still less when, you know, one where he could carry a gun all the time. I mean, as I remember, he'd had, you know, numerous DUIs. He was a violent drunk. And the idea that he was actually in the police force at all had been allowed to stay was absolutely outrageous. And the jury thought so, too. That's why they ordered awarded $44 million. But, you know, as one of the jurors said, we hope this leads to change. I quote one of the jurors in the case who said, we hope this, you know, this sends a message. It didn't. I mean, she said, yeah, look at this. She said, they can't get away with this. It's something that's embedded and it needs to change. But because they could stick this in a bond and, you know, send it, you know, and just basically put it on the credit card and pay the interest to Wall Street investors, you know, there was no real incentive to change.
But on the whole, don't juries tend to favor the police in ambiguous situations?
It's interesting. That's a great question, because they do, you know, what often happens is, there'll be a shooting, say, and the police, and quite often in egregious cases, you know, the relevant policeman will be charged with, you know, homicide or manslaughter or whatever, and on a, you know, criminal charge. And in that case, they do tend to get off. The juries tend to accept the defense that he was in fear of his life. The bar is higher, obviously, in a criminal case. So it's beyond reasonable doubt applies, and in the end they tend to be found not guilty. I mean, there was exceptions, like again in Chicago a couple of weeks ago. But then in a civil trial, the bar is lower. So it's, you know, it's easier to quote unquote convict, or at least to find against the officer, to find against the city. It seems to me the real, you know, main difference for the disparity.
But many cases don't even go to jury trial. Are the police in these cases even considered, thought to have committed a crime? How often do they face prosecution?
Well, not that often. It has to be pretty egregious before they do. I should have the percentage of my fingertips, but I'm sorry, I apologize, I don't. But it's you know, it's the minority of cases. I mean, the police kill 1,000, roughly on average, the police or law enforcement shoot 1,000 people a year. And the number of officers charged is tiny. I'll tell you in a sec. The presumption is, I mean, we're a very, it's a society that, I don't know, is very indulgent towards law. I mean, politically, in recent years, if you go back as, you know, it's been politically advantageous for politicians to promise to crack down on crime. Going back to, you know, think about Nixon's war on crime. Think about, you know, Bill Clinton's 1994 crime bill that he signed. It's something, you know, society tends to be okay with. I've got the figure now of the police kill about 1,000 people a year, and between 2005 and 2017. 80 officers were charged, so that's in 12 years. So let's say 12,000 people were killed, or 12,000 deaths, and just 80 officers were charged with homicide, and a third of those were convicted. So it's pretty. So the odds, if you're a policeman, you shoot someone, the odds are nothing much is going to happen to you.
When he was mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg claimed that holding police more accountable would make New Yorkers less safe. Do you know how he came up with that?
He has a very repressive cast of mind. You know, stop and frisk was, you know, soared to new heights. I mean, I think, didn't he exceed even Rudy Giuliani, which must have taken some doing? Safe from who? Make people less safe from what? Safe from being shot by the police? I don't think so. This whole idea that, that's a sort of a totally repressive law enforcement is good for everyone. It's obviously not. First of all, you make the lives of a lot of people miserable. You lead to absolute distrust of the population, and, you know, and let's be clear, tends to be the minority, but, you know, African Americans and Hispanics and poorer people who then quite reasonably come to distrust law enforcement, so they're not served by law enforcement. You get higher rates of, you know, domestic abuse, whatever. It's obviously a very deleterious thing. I thought Bloomberg, I never thought much of Mayor Bloomberg for his very sort of authoritarian rule in that way.
Now, Patrick Lynch, the president of New York City's Patrolmen's Benevolent Society, has condemned criticism of the police as irresponsible, unjust, and un-American. And he says, if you've never struggled with someone who's resisting arrest, who pulled a gun or knife on you when you're approaching them for breaking a law, then you're not qualified to judge the actions of police officers putting themselves in harm's way for the public good. Well, how often do police officers actually face those kinds of threats?
Well, I mean, often enough, but not as often as they'd have you believe. And let's see, you know, does he include, holding a cell phone as a threat? Let's look at the time, Mr. Lynch would like to, wants to cite the case, the obvious case, you know, the crazed maniac with a gun and what's the police are meant to do. Well, how often do we have when it's the mentally disturbed youth, you know, holding a cell phone or holding a garden rake or whatever. That's just rhetoric.
Has anything changed with the rise of Black Lives Matter? Declines in misconduct be attributed to the awareness that's been fostered by Black Lives Matter and other advocacy groups?
I think it probably has. I don't know if anyone's done a sort of hard enough study to show that that's happened, but I've heard police complaints that they're now less ready to confront, you know, possibly violent offenders for fear of, you know, what lies, you know, that they'll be faced with lawsuits and, you know, the rest of, you know, the publicity. I mean, Black Lives Matter has made a difference. I mean, video, you know, body cams have made a huge difference. Dash cams. I mean, it's, you know, there's now, we now have indisputable records, you know, of these events. I mean, you know, it's interesting in this Chicago case, the Lacan McDonald case. I mean, the defense was, because there was clear video of what had happened, and the defense was, you know, who are you going to believe, me or your lying eyes? Mm-hmm. You know, it was, that's had a huge effect, I think. But I think, you know, there has to be, you know, I don't want to say, you know, they're all, you know, I know talking to where I spend a lot of my time, you know, live in Virginia, I was talking to a county sheriff recently, or several, actually a lot of law enforcement, because I was interested in talking to them, asking about this. I said, well, what's your biggest problem? And they say mental health, you know, without a flicker of hesitation. They said mental health. I mean, we have a huge mental health crisis in the country and, a huge lack of mental health services. So this particular sheriff was saying how his men have to spend, you know, part of every evening dialing around every hospital in Virginia to find a bed for someone they've picked up who is clearly in need of treatment. And they said what we'd like more than anything else would be some sort of database to tell us immediately where there was treatment available. So the police obviously have it's a hard job. I don't want to sound like I'm sort of dissing them totally, but, you know, it comes back to, you know, being held accountable for excessive force, for killing people or for whatever, for which at the moment, thanks to the financial mechanisms available, as we've been discussing, there is no accountability.
But things can improve. According to the New York Post, misconduct suits filed against the NYPD have declined steadily from 3,075 in 2014 to less than half that number, 1,483 in 2018. So is that just something that is unique to New York, or does that reflect a trend across the country?
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, things are improving. I think, you know, the end of cutting, you know, stop and frisk, as beloved by Mayor Bloomberg, you know, curtailing that has probably had a big effect. I think the publicity, you know, there is, you know, well, you mentioned it, I want to give, you know, give tribute to Black Lives Matter. They've had a big effect. You know, other groups, Color of Change and so forth. There is more of a demand for accountability now, more recognition of the problem. So I think it is having an effect, you know, police improvements in police training. Hopefully we'll have more. One of the things that I mentioned earlier in police training, you know, the involvement of former military people. I do worry about the sort of militarization of the police, you know, that you know, you see it visibly with this program of handing the Pentagon, giving police, you know, military weapons, you know, armored personnel carriers and all the rest. That's a very bad trend. So I'm very encouraged, despite that police misconduct cases are dropping.
On the other hand, and we're pretty much out of time, you mentioned that the U.S. spends $100 billion per year on policing and an additional $80 million on incarceration. So,
$80 billion.
$80 billion. Okay.
Yeah.
Are local governments adding funds for anticipated police misconduct to that?
Well, they do. I mean, you know, as I said, there's a certain amount in, you know, most police budgets for certainly big city budgets for police misconduct cases. You know, and the trouble is that gets exceeded, and then we get into the, you know, the brutality bonds stuff we've been talking about. But yeah, it's, you know, it's a huge, we spend a huge amount. There's something, there's an elephant in the room we haven't mentioned. I know we're almost out of time, which is police pensions, which are very generous, along with, you know, firemen's pensions. That's the other stick that's breaking the city budget's back, which is these very, very generous pension agreements, which are a huge strain on big city budgets.
Andrew Coburn's article, Blood Money, Taxpayers Pick Up the Tab for Police Brutality, is in the November issue of Harper's Magazine. And I thank you so much for being on our show today. And that brings us to the end of today's show. My great thanks to Andrew Coburn, to Hugh Sansom, who produced today's segment, to Reggie Johnson, who was at the audio controls, to Charlie Morrow, who composed our theme music, and to my producer, Jesse Lent, who helps make things run smoothly. Leonard Lopate at Large comes to you on Saturdays at 4 and Tuesdays at noon. You can subscribe to Leonard Lopate at Large podcast on iTunes and by clicking on Robin Hood Radio's archive program site, which is robinhoodradio.com. You can also check out Leonard Lopate at Large Facebook page. We hope to see you next week.